Hey everybody, this is Max. This is part two of Pat and I's conversation with New York game designer Zach Gage. This sort of continues our dry, boring, technical conversation about game design and philosophy and all kinds of issues. This episode, I finally am able to steer the conversation towards talking about the game that Pat and I wanted to cover, which is The Witness. And we do spoil some pretty big parts of the game. You know, I don't know if it's like game-ruiningly bad spoilers, but it's definitely a game. I don't say this about many things, but The Witness is definitely a game that is better if you go in fresh and you don't know anything about it, and there are some really cool surprises that we give away. So probably skip this one if you haven't played The Witness. That being said, I think I covered everything you need to know in the last episode. Zach's work can be found at stfj.net, and thanks again to Zach for joining us. Here's the episode.
You mentioned that there seem to be like two types of people. There are the routine problem solvers and the non-routine problem solvers. And now the general impression that I got is that the concept of being a non-routine problem solver was considered like extraordinarily valuable, or more importantly to say that it's preferential to being a routine problem solver.
I think so, in the sense that, I mean, you know, in some ways, our education system is sort of built to turn out factory workers. And if you're a factory worker, it's much better to be able to solve routine problems as quickly as possible, right? That's a tremendously right. valuable skill if you're building a car and you're building the same car over and over and over again. So, you know, it's not necessarily true. But on the other hand, being a non-routine problem solver, being a good problem solver, allows you to, you know, learn anything you want or invent something new or, you know, solve complicated things that other people might not solve. So if you're, you know, in the vanguard in academia and like you're a super hotshot physicist or mathematics professor and you're doing research, or if you're an entrepreneur or if you're an artist, then it's very valuable to be a non-routine problem solver and to be really good at it.
Right. Well, and what I really want to know, because like, and this feels a little tangential, but it's such an absolute map onto those behaviors, is, you know, because I've ended up having to hire people to help me with my charity and with all these projects that I run. And I had some, but I have no training in management or human resources, or I've never hired anyone. And so initially, you know, I made a huge mess of everything. And I had one friend introduce me to a framework, and he said there are effectively three types of people that you can employ. He says you have drones, you have operators, and you have creatives. And he goes, a drone is not a bad thing. He goes, this framework was created by somebody who does beekeeping, and drones are very useful. I mean, they're the most productive, you know, entities in a beehive. He says, you know, operators are people that organize things and create frameworks within which people operate, and creatives are, you know, are people that come up with ideas. Sleep until noon. And of course, everyone has varying degrees of all of these, but we do tend to specialize in one. And you know, and we were talking about somebody, and he goes, the problem is that person thinks they're a operator, but they're really a creative. What you need to do is you need to take a creative and surround them with operators who will then harvest their ideas and implement them. And similarly, they said, you know, and one of my problems is I wanted to hire all problem solvers and doers. And so I hired a bunch of operators, and the problem is that people that are good at it's just like you mentioned with this factory worker mentality, I realized that some of these people who are great problem solvers, who really could think outside the box and deal with, like, whenever we have a project come up, it's always a brand new project, like nothing we've ever done before. But those people, like, really suck at repetitive tasks. This is why I need to ask. This implication seems to be that if you engage in certain processes, you can improve people's ability to solve problems, to be these non-routine problem solvers. Does that impact their ability to effectively be good routine problem solvers and be content in routine problem solving?
Well, I have sort of an anecdote. I know that the best answer to a scientific question is just like someone's crazy anecdote, so I'm happy to share mine. So this is a story about how I played The Witness. So Veronica, I was very excited for The Witness. I've been following the development of it for years and years and years, and stayed very spoiler free and all of that. And when it came out, Veronica loves puzzles, and she writes puzzles, and she's incredible at solving them. And I'm good at some kinds of problem solving, but I'm not a big puzzle person. So I was like, we're going to play this game together. And the division of labor, it was sort of interesting finding how we would play the game together. So initially, like, I thought maybe she would sort of be the pilot, like she would steer the guy around the island. But she's really bad at doing the dual thumbsticks. So what would happen is she would sort of like point the character in the direction that she wanted to go, and then move orthogonally and move her hand over and move like orthogonally. And then when it was like when we'd hit like a river or we couldn't proceed, she would like move her hand back over and adjust where we were looking, and then move back over to the other stick and move orthogonally. So that lasted for about 10 minutes. And I was like, okay, I'm driving, you're solving the puzzles. And where we really found an interesting division of labor was I was very good at, there's some puzzles in The Witness that are like lateral thinking puzzles. So like I'm thinking specifically of the sound puzzles. Those were probably my favorite puzzles in the game.
Oh, I was so bad at those.
And I've heard they're the least completed puzzles in the game. And I've heard many anecdotes of like people are frustrated with them. And I investigated the situation. I figured out what it was immediately. And then every twist they threw, I was just like, pow, 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 solved it really quickly. I was like fully engaged in it. And like, I was like, the hair was standing up on the back of my neck. And I was like in a state of flow. I was like, I am nailing these, like every twist they sent. And the whole time Veronica was like, slow down, what's happening? Like, what the hell are you doing? And I was like, no, it's so simple. You just listen to the thing and then it follows the sound wave. So I just blew through those. But similar, but like on the other hand, there were puzzles like the Tetris ones where it was like I vaguely sort of understood the underlying logic and I knew there was this repeatable process, but I lacked the, after the first two, I was like, I am ready to jump off a bridge. Like I cannot keep doing these. And Veronica was like, had a pad of graph paper and she was into it. She was just like, I am fucking mowing through these puzzles. And I was like, how are you doing this? And then, of course, like that really became an issue because I was the one who became like addicted to the game. And I was like, we cannot eat or sleep until we solve this like area. I went like full Jumanji and I was like, we have to solve the puzzles. And Veronica was like, it is 1 a.m. We need to go to sleep. And I was like, get your graph paper. We're getting off this island. So I think like a lot of things, it's not to bring this back to your question, Pat, it's not as simple of a question as like, are you good at one or are you good at the other? Because I think there's like probably some like deconstruction that can be done on like, what does it mean to be good at something? Like, what is it to be an expert at something? A lot of times it's just being willing to do a lot of work on it and to use your whole brain and pour your effort into it. And it's like, are you having fun? Does it motivate you to participate in it fully? And for me, it's like, I think I probably could have done those Tetris puzzles if like my life was on the line, but it wasn't, and I didn't find them fun, and so I wasn't good at them. And you know, similarly, like Veronica probably could have reasoned out those sound puzzles eventually, but it just, you know, it was like, it was so agonizing and frustrating trying to guess what the rules were that she just turned off and didn't want to do it.
I think that like that particular type of complaint is very common of constructivist tutorial issues, which is that like some people are into certain types of things and have certain skills and other people have other types of skills, and it's very hard to build something that's going to keep all of those people engaged and happy. But it does happen that, you know, people who want to But the weird thing is that it happens more in constructivism than it does in problem solving, because if you've set up problem solving correctly, people may end up walking away from it, but they won't end up being frustrated. Whereas in constructivism, people can get so bored that things just become, it feels like they're being assigned busy work. Whereas people who are frustrated with Pac-Man will just say, like, I don't really want to play Pac-Man anymore. It's not as much of a work thing. I think, I don't know, maybe I'm way off on that. You know, ultimately, like, I'm an artist and I'm not an academic and I haven't done scientific research on this, so I don't entirely know the answer to that question. But my stance on problem solving and teaching problem solving is that, like, critical thought is sort of the core of all of the work that I do. So all of the art that I do is about trying to push people in to critically engage with the systems that are around us, and all the games I do are about trying to push people who, you know, might not be engaging with a game that's super critical thought intensive and sort of trick them into it. And I think it's, like, my sense is, like, everybody in the world has done tremendous amounts of problem solving and critical thought, because it's literally how everybody starts. Like, if you survived being, you know, 8, you've basically made your way through critical problem solving in the same way that everybody in the world has always has been a game designer, because a core stage of growing up is designing little games and playing them with your friends. And I think as we move to being adults, we end up being pushed very strongly in a way to engage with pattern matching and less problem solving, except for certain career paths and or for certain people who have kinds of drive. And I think there's only good to come from pushing people to explore a little bit of this thing that they used to do that everybody used to be really good at, and bring a little bit of that into their lives, and just as, like, a way to, you know, having giving people a new tool that they used to understand but never really brought into their adult life.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And in my teaching, you know, and it seems weird that because what I would primarily teach is just freshman English, but I really viewed it as one of my primary missions was to get the students to engage in critical thinking, like, and kind of show them the ropes of critical thinking. It's, in my opinion, it's a huge crime if a college curriculum does not require, you know, and integrate critical thinking into the curriculum in a mandatory way. You know, a lot of times you can use a critical thinking class to fulfill, like, a GDR, but, you know, it, in my opinion, that's not a real integrated approach to teaching critical thinking. That's
Pat, do you know that this is a partisan political issue that you're describing?
Oh, I absolutely do, and it makes a ton of sense, because why would Republicans ever want somebody to be able to think critically?
It sounds funnier. I think it sounds like maybe we're making a joke or being mean, but I was actually really surprised to learn that this is, like, an active like I said, like an active partisan political issue, and the Democratic Party and liberals support the teaching of critical thinking, and the Republican Party opposes by policy the teaching of critical thinking. This is from the 2012 Republican Party platform, which is their official statement of the things that the party believes. They said under knowledge-based education, we oppose the teaching of higher order thinking skills, critical thinking skills, and similar programs that are simply a relabeling of outcome-based education, which focuses on behavior modification and has the purposes of challenging the students' fixed beliefs and undermining parental authority.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's what the Republican Party's party platform is.
I'm a little surprised they state it in such an outright manner, but I am not surprised about the concept at all. It's sort of, you know, one of the fundamental divides is that typically somebody who is a progressive or a liberal, I don't like to think, I just don't tend to think in terms of Democrat or Republic. I tend to think of, I think in different shapes or different terms, but, you know, generally speaking, like a liberal wants everyone to go and vote, and a Republican wants Republicans to go and vote.
Well, I don't want to put Zach on the spot, but do you want to talk about, like, your experience with The Witness?
Sure. I mean, so, well, My experience, it's not going to be super long. This, I think Max and I had a conversation about this a while ago, because Max really loved The Witness, and I did not really love The Witness, although I certainly respect The Witness. And I think, kind of structurally, The Witness is maybe one of the most beautiful and impressive games that's ever been made. I don't think I've ever walked around a 3D world where I felt like every single spot had been composed and built in a way that would be beautiful before, and that I found totally awe-inspiring. But I think Jonathan Blow is a really interesting person, and in some ways we're very similar in our goals, but I think the methods that we achieve them are very, very different, and I think that made me feel a little weird about The Witness because of his approach. It's just so different than what I would approach. But in general, I think both Jonathan and I are very interested in having people think and find epiphany and value critical thought and discovery, so that they can take that because like critical thought is so much work, but what happens when you do it a lot is you get addicted to it, and the product of it is something that you can feel proud about and excited about and tell people about. And so I think the more people who are engaging with that and using it well is really good. And I think Jonathan Blow totally agrees on that point. And that's really what The Witness is built to do. Is he, you know, has an interview said that he wanted to build a game that was very timeless, and that anyone could sit down and they could start out and just follow the game, and the game would teach them everything that they would need to know up to a point where they would have these like genuine epiphanies and feel really, really great about themselves. And I kind of feel like, well, Pac-Man does that, right? So it's like, it's just this, The Witness uses this constructivist method, and what the constructivist method requires is this tremendous amount of effort and care and like careful construction to build this world that delivers what it needs to deliver to people to get to where it wants to go, and also to be super heavily targeted, so that like The Witness is a game about epiphany. It's like you bought a book called How to Have an Epiphany, and you read the book, and by the end of the book you have an epiphany, and it's an amazing epiphany. But to me, it's kind of like, I just wonder, you know, the games that I try to make are, you know, instead of playing a 20-hour game, you know, when you play Pac-Man, you can have an epiphany, and it's a small epiphany, but it's just as powerful, and in some ways the depth, you know, in some ways it's not as powerful because it doesn't have the clear story behind it, not like a narrative story of what The Witness is, but like your experiential story of how you navigated that. I think when you play Pac-Man, you're far less aware of that experiential story, and most people just play Pac-Man and then they go, oh, that was really fun, I liked it, and it was clever.
So I had a very fun experience with The Witness. I loved it. I have wonderful gaming memories of playing it with Veronica. On the balance, I think it was an impeccable game. But I do think it's a legitimate, you know, one of my frustrations with the game was I wanted an experience. There were some moments in The Witness where I felt like I was employing the use of deductive reasoning to build and validate theories about the world, and those were electrifying. I mean, I was totally, it was like an adrenaline rush. But I felt that the game, it provided some of those moments, but I felt that on the balance, it was more about induction. It was more about walking you through these very prescribed steps of do this puzzle, now learn this rule, now do this puzzle, now learn this rule, now do this puzzle. And you felt as though you had many options of like, well, you could go to this world, or you could go to that world to do the puzzles, but really they were each sort of tutorialized in the same rote way. And I feel like it was not, for the most part, on the balance, the game was not teaching me heuristics and rules with which I could go solve problems on my own, but rather it was sort of through repetition prescribing exactly what I should do next. And I was often disappointed. There were some points where I would get stuck on a puzzle and I would think to myself, this one I can't solve yet. I need to like use deductive reasoning and environmental clues and think laterally to come up with the solution. And I would go explore and look around and find all this amazing detail in the world, and I'd be like, maybe this is a clue, maybe that's a clue. And none of them were clues. I just wasn't working hard enough on the puzzle.
So I felt that that was a frustration I had with the game, and you know, think compare it's sort of it's so in some ways it's so like rude to compare it to Pac-Man. It's so funny to me, but in you know, Pac-Man is a purely deductive experience. They're not it's not telling you what to do next. You have to build, you make your own theory about how to play it, and then test the theory.
Right. I mean, I think the more apt comparison, I guess, is like Myst is sort of the opposite of The Witness, even though they look very similar. Which is Myst is really about deductive reasoning and like being able to apply things in abstract ways. There are very few puzzles in Myst that are solved by sort of trial and error or by following a set of prescribed rules that have just been told to you. But I think the issue that you're having, I mean, ultimately, I didn't finish The Witness because I solved 200 puzzles and I realized that there were 600 puzzles and I said, I don't want to solve 600 puzzles. It's not worth it. I could go play something very small and meaningful and enjoy it just as much. And so I think, you know, the real danger of constructivism and kind of the hilarity of constructivism is that if you're not in a space where you are a human being watching someone, the only way that you can confirm that they know something is by asking them to demonstrate it. And so many games in tutorials ask you to demonstrate things, and a lot of the time those things are things that you really have either are ridiculous to demonstrate or completely impossible for you to demonstrate. So like a really good example is in Assassin's Creed 2, they realized that they wanted anyone to be able to play this because they view Assassin's Creed as like a mainstream movie franchise. And so they make you walk through a hallway for 2 minutes to show that you can use dual thumbsticks. But walking through a hallway for 2 minutes is not going to teach somebody who doesn't know how to use dual thumbsticks well enough to use them in Assassin's Creed. And for somebody who does know how to use them, it's the most boring sequence in the world. And the problem is they basically didn't build the sequence that was long enough or complete enough to give this experience to people, because if they'd done that, then all the people who wanted to just play Assassin's Creed would not have even played the game at all. And really, the way that most people learn to use dual thumbsticks are playing hundreds of games and hundreds of hours and getting acclimated to the things. And so you really kind of see that in The Witness, where you're like, well, all right, I don't want to do these six puzzles because I already get it. But for somebody who doesn't get it, if those six puzzles weren't there, that person would be lost and they'd have no way to get back on the train unless they like went to a game fact site and kind of ruined the experience for themselves.
It's probably also worth noting that like that idea of like teaching the game mechanics through playing the game in a way where it's not apparently tutorialized. Like that was a thing that was introduced to myself and a lot of people in video games in a very clear way in Braid. Like Braid was one of the first games I played where I really thought about how the game was teaching me how to play it, and it was so different. It was such a paradigm shift. I mean, it was such a breath of fresh air. So, you know, this is Jonathan Blow's first game or first solo game before The Witness. So I think it's like, to some degree, I think it's like he is the guy to have made this game.
Right. Braid had the exact right number of puzzles, and they were just abstract and difficult enough. In fact, I think a lot of The Witness was perhaps a response on his part to looking at Braid and realizing how many people who are out there just didn't get it. Like, you look at, you know, videos online of people just getting stoked about the rewind mechanics, and then they just never figured out how the game worked. And I think, you know, this is purely speculation, but I think Jonathan Blow looked at Braid and thought, wow, those people really missed the experience of the game. How do I build a game in such a way that every single person who sits down with it will get to the thing that I care about and not just some cool game feel thing that is, you know, ultimately rather foolish.
You know, it's interesting to hear both of you talk about The Witness, because it feels like you're talking about it almost in the same way that I talk about Harry Potter. Well, no, that's not a good comparison, but it seems like you're both saying, you know, I really admire it. It was amazingly well executed. You know, it was so well put together. But underneath that surface seems to be you guys saying that you didn't enjoy it, or you don't think that it did the right thing.
Well, I think I actually really did enjoy it. I mean, like I said, I went like full Jumanji on this game of like, I can't sleep until it's done. Like, I was consumed by it, and I have very fond memories of playing it. But, you know, I think it's like, I think any kind of art, in some sense, it's kind of the weird, it's kind of like the cruel thing of like making really high art is that it invites everyone to pick it apart and find the little things that they want to complain about or do better, right? It's like, how much, you know, it's like a lot more criticism goes into looking at like masterpiece films and looking at every little misstep or continuity error in a great film than like a shitty film, right? Uh-huh. So The Witness is like, to me, it was a really, I felt that it was a sublime experience, but I nonetheless, it's very hard for me to look at it totally divorced from my perspective as a creator and say, well, what if this had been a little bit different? What if I had done it this way? What about this? What about that? And I don't know that that's a fair or a generous way to have an art experience, but it is part of what I bring to the table when I play a game.
Well, I think it's unavoidable too, as, I mean, I read books differently than regular people read books. And, you know, I tell a lot of people, they're like, oh, can you read, you know, an advanced copy of my book and maybe give it a blurb? And I say, I'm doing revisions right now, which means my critical faculty is revved up to its maximum extent. I go, me reading your book will be the equivalent of me feeding it into a chipper shredder, which means if I love it, I'll be able to gush. But otherwise, it's like I'm going to find 10,000 things wrong with it because that's what my brain is trying to do right now. So I get that. You when you approach your art, you know, the more you engage in your craft, the more sensitive to subtle failures of craft you become. I just want to say my experience of The Witness, to touch on something that one of you said, where you could experience frustration. That's something that I feel is generally lost in current games. And here, I don't know how old you are, Zach.
31.
Okay. So I got 10 years on you. Did you play Infocom games, or did those come too early for you?
I've played some of them looking... Well, so I played... I guess Syndicate was not Infocom.
No, it's like Zork, Leather Goddesses of
Oh, Opos. Sorry. Yeah. Right. Wow. Sorry. Yes, I played Zork. I did not beat Zork, but I grew up on the Mac, so there were not very many games, and at some point someone got me a CD of Infocom Classics, so I've played them a little bit, but I definitely did not get deep in them.
And see, that's just it. If you got them on CD, that means that you've pretty much, you played them in the realm of the internet. And those early Infocom games, not only were they pre-internet, they were practically almost like modem, you know?
Right.
And what would happen is you lived in this world and it was all text, and you would type, pick up the brass lamp, and it would say, taken, and it would be in your inventory, and then it would describe something. You'd say, go west, and you would be in a new room, and you'd say, look at the lichen on the wall, and then it would describe the lichen on the wall. Then you'd say, eat the lichen, and it would say, I don't know what that means. You know, right. It was really frustrating because it was a pure text game, and what they did with the text parser was really amazing, but it was still, that was the frustrating mechanic. But more importantly, you were asked to really legitimately solve, I think that's most emblematic of the non-routine problems that have ever existed in games, because, you know, spoiler alert, I remember some of these puzzles. Like, there was a riddle that baffled me and my friend Chad for like 6 months. And this is in the sixth grade, mind you. Can you imagine a sixth grade kid today being baffled about a riddle for 6 months? It's impossible to conceive of, because you could go to the fucking internet and type in the riddle and find the result. And I remember the riddle word for word. It was, tall as a house, round as a cup, and all the king's horses can't draw it up. What am I?
Say it one more time. What is it?
Tall as a house, round as a cup, and all the king's horses can't draw it up. What am I? And we talked about it, and we talked about it. There was another one in one of the later Zorks that was, my tines be long, my tines be short, my tines end ere my first report. And I puzzled over that. What is a tine? You look it up in the dictionary, you know, and it says it's a tine is like what comes off a fork, you know, it's a tine of a fork, or like a jag of lightning. All those little jags are tines. And so, like, I learned these words and I looked at the puzzle and I'm like, Jesus, how do I figure this out? And so what I experienced, what I learned to experience.
Well, what's the answers?
Well, you know, how about, see, here's the thing. And I know you, Max, what you're going to do is you're going to think about it for a couple minutes. Then you're going to go to the internet, aren't you?
I have Google open now, so we could do this the hard way or the easy way.
You know what that makes you?
What?
It makes you a quitter.
A filthy casual.
Like everyone in your fucking generation. And it because you have not learned to deal with frustration the way that I did. Playing these Infocom games, I beat my head bloody against that. And you know what we eventually did? We solved that fucking riddle with the brute force power of our fucking sixth grade intellects. And when we did, the sensation of accomplishment we achieved eclipses anything available in games today. You know, the trial and error that we experience there is indescribable, if not inconceivable, in modern games to any extent. However, and one of the reasons I will say The Witness is, you know, will always have a place in my heart. I don't know if I can say it's my favorite game, because ultimately it's not a narrative experience, and my heart lies in narrative.
And you didn't, in all of the talking about the game, you don't perceive a narrative in how you played it?
Oh, I mean, there is a sort of narrative. Absolutely, there's a sort of narrative. There's theme. There is some of this, but it's not a narrative. But
I don't mean game. A narrative in the game. I mean, the narrative is an emergent property of you playing the game.
Yes,
you're telling me lots of stories about your playing the game.
Oh, exactly. My experience of the game is absolutely a narrative, but that's not typically what I.
But why not? Why not? Why is that? To me, that's more. This relates back to what we were talking about last week. But to me, that's the higher art. I'm not that impressed. I just think games that have like dialogue in them, and they're like, you're like proceeding through this plot. That's just a shitty book. I don't want to read a shitty book.
Well, and I agree with you there, because a lot of those games are shitty books. But a game that does that well, and that's because those games are not taking advantage of the opportunities available to the narrative medium presented in games.
But yeah, most games are essentially a thriller that you would buy at an airport, and then every page you have to stop at a knee-height wall and stop and shoot at people before you can turn the page and move on.
Exactly, and that's not taking advantage. Of course, if a video game tries to be a book, it will be a bad book. In the same way that if a book tries to be a movie, it will be a bad movie.
But I think this is a big idea across John Blow's, you know, all of his work, and specifically that comes across strongly for me in The Witness, is that the narrative and the mechanics should be one. It's like, yes. I always think of, there's like a Frank Lloyd Wright quote where he's like, you know, there's a thing in architecture of like form follows function, and or you know, which is more primary or whatever. And Frank Lloyd Wright had this great quote that he's like, great architecture is the sacred unity of form and function as one. So it's almost like deconstructing the whole difference between form and function. Something is beautiful because of how it works, or it works because it's beautiful. It's all the same thing. And I think that John Blow is trying to collapse the distinction between mechanics and narrative to the point where what the mechanics are, the story are, the narrative, it's all one thing. And to me, that's where I have a very deep art experience and engagement with The Witness, is I can tell you rich narrative stories about my time in the world, what I did, how I solved problems, where I went, my feelings, the emotional arc, the failures, the triumphs, all the things of a good story, and it's not programmed in the game. It's something that only exists with me.
And that's true, and I get that. That's probably a little less appealing to me, because I make story every day for a living. so the opportunity to make more story in a game is less.
So this is like when comedians are like, "Oh, I hate Cards Against Humanity because it's like, why aren't I writing these jokes?"
No. It's it. Again, I'm the one, I think, of the three of us that loves this game the most, with the least reservation.
Yeah, but you love it in the wrong way, and I'm from the internet, and I'm here to correct you.
But let me finish this thing that I feel The Witness has done in a way that I never thought I would see again in games. And here I get to be old man Rothfuss. But I played The Witness, and I'm going through, and I solve puzzles, and I feel good. Because, yeah, I get a little serotonin bump. I get a feeling of accomplishment. And I would actually argue that in some ways, The Witness is almost like the diametrical opposite of a mobile app game. But I want to push off that conversation to later. I don't want to talk about those right now. Because as I play through, I would hit a point in the game, and I would think, I can't solve this puzzle. And I would think it, and I'd go, and it wasn't just I can't solve it. I looked at the puzzle, and I tried to solve it. And then I would think, oh, this is a huge bug to make it into so beautiful a game that they has put a puzzle in here that cannot be solved. And then I thought, oh, maybe this is the one puzzle in the game that you can't solve. It would make sense to have one puzzle like that in the game that nobody could solve, because that is a worthwhile experience for a game like this. But I would still try to solve it. And then I would have this moment where I'm like, oh, I've been thinking of it the wrong way. And then I would turn this corner, and it was like pieces fitting together in my head. And I experienced that moment of frustration and the true belief that this problem was unsolvable. And then I solved it at least two or three dozen times over the course of this game. And therefore, it's not that this game taught me how to solve these puzzles. The true thing that this game taught me, and that I think this is what truly will make this game worth so much forever, is the fact that this game teaches people that things that initially seem insurmountable are very surmountable. You can do it. You just need to keep at it. And it does that again and again and again in ways that are very bite-sized and therefore very accessible to many, many people. I can think of very few lessons that are more important to try to bring to the general populace in this day and age than, if you stick at it, you can do it. It seems hard. It seems impossible. You can do it. You can do it. Just stick at it. You can figure it out. You're smart enough. That's a huge thing. And I've never seen a game do that as well.
In game design, one of the big sort of academic subjects that people talk about is trying to come up with like a theory of fun, of what makes something fun. And one of my favorite theories is from Zach's colleague, Bennett Foddy, at the NYU Game Center. And Bennett has this theory of fun that Bennett believes that fun is a result of pain, nausea, and confusion, and specifically experiencing those things and overcoming them. And this theory is, one thing he can look at is, how do children play on the playground? What kind of activities do they do to have fun? Well, they hurt each other, they hit each other, they spin around until they're dizzy and induce nausea, or they are in a confusing situation and then solve it, figuring out just the puzzles of everyday life. And Bennett certainly makes games that are painful, make you nauseous and confused. He's the creator of Quap and GURP and all of those games. But one of his criticisms of like AAA games and big popular video games is that they have this extensive playtesting, and what that does is they systematically identify areas in the game where you're in pain, you're nauseous, or you're confused, and then they sand those away. They identify those as problems and get rid of them. And the result is you're never really overcoming those obstacles, and therefore you're never really having fun. And I think this is something I've heard like John Blow talk about very specifically in interviews, is how much in The Witness it's about the endorphin rush of solving a problem, which requires having a problem to solve that's actually difficult.
Yes. Actual difficulty. Actual difficulty is such a fucking rare resource these days in games. And it's something that I'm super curmudgeonly about.
This, I mean, this is an idea that comes up a lot on the podcast, right? Of like, this is sort of like a Buddhist idea of like, well, good luck trying to separate suffering and pleasure or pain and desire. Good luck, like, peeling those things apart where you have a life where you just have the most pleasure and you satisfy the most desires, but you're never suffering and you never want anything and you're never bored. You know what I mean? It's like they're kind of it's this idea in deconstruction of like it's kind of one thing. It's like, well, what if you never are heartbroken? How do you really understand what love is?
It's, I think, yeah, in some ways it ties into being able to, I don't know if I buy into the trope of like, oh, if you're never unhappy, how can you appreciate when you're happy? Believe me, I've been happy for long stretches of time and it does not get old.
But no, but that's not the point. The point, though, is that you wouldn't you wouldn't be able to properly contextualize the happiness, even no matter how long you have it, if you didn't know it in opposition to unhappiness. That they're not two separate things. That happiness and unhappiness are one thing.
That's such fucking hippie New Age bullshit. What it is happiness.
Oh, well, excuse me. Let's get Derrida to call in on the next episode.
Oh, don't you dare fucking bring it. Fucking Derrida is the biggest wanker. He took a shit in the cultural consciousness, the size of which. Oh, Derrida.
I mean, Pat, you just have to deconstruct there being a shit in the public consciousness from there now, not being a shit in the public consciousness. They're one. It's one thing.
You're just baiting me because I must have told you how much I hate Derrida and everything that he stands for, right?
I'm not a deconstructivist. Like I'm way more into other sort of like modern philosophical ideas. But there's something to it. I mean, I think it's a valuable tool, and I think it's like, what better illustration than The Witness? Of like, The Witness is such a fun. We both had such a fun experience of it because it was hard. It was like we had pleasure that's inseparable from the difficulty of the game and the frustration of not solving it. It's like, you can't feel good about solving the puzzle if that wasn't preceded by not solving it. That's yeah. One thing.
I'm so interested in the way that Pat is interested in the types of problems that you're interested in solving and how that relates to your interest in terms of narrative. Because to me, like, I think what you said about The Witness is truly The Witness's most amazing accomplishment, and it really does do that. But to me, like, I'm much more interested in Max's understanding and triumph over Spelunky, because it's a space where, you know, I also beat hell in Spelunky, and it was a huge accomplishment for me, but the way that I did it was probably very different than the way that Max did it, and there is no single solution to Spelunky. There's an array of parts, and it gives you just enough tools to figure out how to play and, like, both upgrade your skill and upgrade your, like, cognitive understanding of how the game is working, whereas many of the puzzles in The Witness, you know, once you've solved them, the story was very rote, and you did it, and you got to the end, but the puzzle, the, like, structure, you know, when we talk about how to solve Tetris puzzles, there's not really a bunch of different ways to solve Tetris puzzles. Maybe there's, like, one or two, but for the most part, it's a puzzle based on a specific set of solutions, whereas Spelunky is, like, a morass of ideas and restrictions that you have to navigate yourself, and it lends itself much more to the type of story that I find valuable in games, which is totally different than what you find valuable, which is, like, one of my teachers once said, it's, if you ask a soccer player what the story of a game is, you know, a soccer player likes a game that tied, because that's a very tense and exciting game to play. But for a soccer fan is interested in a game that's a blowout, because the narrative structure of their understanding of soccer is more of a straightforward linear narrative and not an experiential narrative. And so when you're playing a game, for me, I feel like the valuable story is the story of the soccer player, where you have a draw and it's this tense moment where everything is going back and forth, whereas a book is more of the narrative story of a blowout.
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. The one for me is like, if for role-playing games, I know I experience, because I've played for a long time and I've played with people who have played for a long time, and for me, what's interesting is seeing the different sort of character that people create as they progress as like role-playing game players. Because initially we almost all start is like, you want a super powerful character, you know, you want great stats, you want great spells, you want the ability to withstand and deal damage and all of this.
You
want to
cast level 3 spells at that Balrog all day.
All day. You know, you want the ring of infinite third level spell casting, you know? But then what's interesting is you do that for a while and then that story becomes tired. And then, so you're like, well, you know, I don't want to be this wizard anymore. Maybe I want to try a different character. And then sometimes you want to play sometimes you'll do an interesting character. It's the concept of the character where I remember, you know, starting a game for some friends and I'm like, okay, you're young heroes, you're going out into the world to make your fortune. So you're starting very low level, but you eventually you're going to try to go out and be heroes in a small scale and make names for yourself. And so my friend sat down, he goes, I'm a hunchback with a club foot. And my name's Claude. And I'm like, God damn it. No, Johnson, we're not doing this. You're supposed to be a hero. And he's like, no, no, no. He's an alchemist. He trained at the university. He can do this. So I let him play this character. And Claude was amazing because Johnson had played a bunch of games and he could have tried to make somebody really powerful or made somebody whatever. But instead, what he did is made a character that was very interesting, who was trying to be a hero, who wasn't necessarily designed to be a hero. And his appreciation of narrative had progressed to the point where he wasn't interested in that previous story. Now, here's the tricky bit, is we all go through journeys like this as we experience more and more story, or we become more adept at our craft. And it's so easy for all of us to like look at where we are and view this as the end of a linear progression and say, ah, I have reached a higher level of understanding or appreciation I can grasp the craft on such a deep level that all of my previous thoughts were silly in some way or wrong in some way. But the truth is, to all of the people on this spectrum taking their individual journeys, the things that they know are still true things. The experiences that they have are very true experiences and very worthwhile experiences. And I think that's why so much of this story creation or this game creation is so difficult, because we want to be appealing to everyone no matter where they are on their particular journey, while still doing something that's satisfying for us on our particular journey. I think that's like one of the hardest things to do as a creator, is to not get so far up our own asses that we preclude anyone else enjoying what we're trying to create. Well, also, Max, is just to put a pin in this, we still haven't talked about Inside, which I played.
Ooh, did you like it?
We will talk.
Well, teaser, that's some pro shit.